You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, October 27th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, from Slate Online Magazine, Dahlia Lithwick on Occupy Wall Street and how it is just driving Fox News and the pundit class crazy. Really incredible moments last night as occupiers were marching in Boston, in New York, in solidarity with people who were marching in Oakland and San Francisco last night. We've got audio. Also, Democrats on the super committee sell out all of us or just engage in a kabuki dance to appeal to people who are irrelevant. I'm sure there's a third choice. I just don't know what it is. But I'm... we got to pull that... always looking at the bright side of life. We will talk about that. Mitt Romney, still a flip-flopper, a funny story, and of course Herman Cain still insane. We will talk about that if we get to it. SEC rules watered down. Wall Street, you will get what you deserve. Last night in Oakland, Occupy Oakland General Assembly called for a general strike on November 2nd, that's next week. We'll talk about that later in the program, but I just wanted to put it out there. I don't think it's going to get much support. That's not a lot of time to rev people up for a general strike. With that said, I think we're going to have to see multiple attempts at creating a general strike. It may not be until the spring. But I think we're going to see a general strike in this country. I was talking about it yesterday with Doug Henwood. And I don't know when the last time we've had a general strike in this country. I don't know if it happened during the 60s. I really don't. But I think we're going to see one in 2012. And I think we're going to see a massive one. Could be wrong, but I think it's going to take multiple attempts at it before we get there. I've got audio of last night. I was up all night. I did Keith Olbermann's program on Countdown, which we'll try and put on the better half of the show if we can find that audio. And I was talking to him about the latest Fox News story exposing Occupy Wall Street. We'll mention it in the interview with Dahlia when we talk to Dahlia. But and afterwards, I came home, started watching all of the Occupy streams in San Francisco, Oakland, multiple ones in New York. Occupy Wall Street left Zuccotti, or formerly named Zuccotti Park, went to City Hall Square. Surrounding City Hall Square, there was one or two arrests there. The cops didn't seem to know what to do exactly. They were in riot gear, but they just I want to say up front, there were a couple incidents where cops were, where one cop was just beating the crap out of a guy. Actually, a couple of cops. But on the whole, and to be fair, there were also circumstances where I think there were Occupy Wall Street people being a little bit antagonistic. Now, cops are professionally trained to deal with this. That's their job. You know, cops get a very good pension. They can get it in 22 years. Their pay is not so great in New York City. Pensions are better. They deserve every penny of it because they have to put up with stuff like this. That's their job. But I think they you do need to look and see how vicious the Oakland police were and know that at the very least the police in New York City are either more just simply professionally trained or in general are better guys and girls, as it were. For the most part, they really maintain their composure. Last night, the march sort of broke up. It streamed out of City Hall and made their way through downtown New York, went up Broadway, in and out of traffic, stopping traffic for about 25, 30 blocks. And this was probably the one of the most amazing moments of it. And this is the narration from one of these guys from The Other 99. This is a great stream on Ustream, The Other 99. There are two guys who run it. This is usually the guy who just shoots. He doesn't do the narration, but he lost the guy who usually does the who's usually the correspondent. This guy's okay. The other guy is really fantastic. I mean, they're both good. But the other guy's really fantastic. They really, really describe where they are, what's going on, give it some context. But this guy, this is a great coverage by the cameraman because he had lost the narrator. And let's play this. This is one of the most interesting moments of the evening. Oh, this is, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Back full of equipment as I'm doing this. I'm hearing screaming. They've taken the net. The protesters have pulled the net away from the police. The police are falling. The net has been claimed by the protesters. Tonight belongs to Occupy Wall Street. I want to say that one more time for everybody. Breaking news. The protesters have taken the orange net from the police and are holding it above their heads in triumph. I saw a few police stumble. What you're seeing right now is them holding the orange net. This is amazing. They're carrying the net over cars. This is the famous kettling net that was used on the Brooklyn Bridge protests.
So basically what it was is the cops had brought out the kettling net. This is the what you saw in that famous video of the Tony Baloney, and we'll give an update on Tony Baloney. How do you spell his name now? STATENISLAND. But this was the net that those women were trapped in when he sprayed them with pepper spray, and or not that specific one, I don't think. And the protesters just essentially grabbed it from the police and just ran up Broadway with it. It was pretty amazing. We've got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Dahlia Lithwick from Slate on just how the pundit class and Fox News and the Breitbarts of the world and all those people who want to disparage Occupy Wall Street are dealing with the movement. And I got to tell you, here's a hint. They're not dealing with it very well. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is always a pleasure to welcome to the program Dahlia Lithwick. What is your specific title over at Slate? I always ask you this. Is it are you editor in chief yet?
No. I'm just a legal guy, Sam.
Well,
I'm the legal reporter.
If it was up to me, Dahlia.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I saw your piece, I guess you posted it last night, and
yeah.
I went on to Countdown last night to talk about the same thing, and I'm fascinated by it. You talk about how Occupy Wall Street confuses and ignores Fox and the pundit class, and there really are two different sort of like categories here between Fox and the pundit class, and on the Fox side, I include people like Andrew Breitbart, who I have an unhealthy desire and compulsion to harass about stuff like this on Twitter. Tell me how Occupy Wall Street confuses the pundit class.
Well, I think it's more that the pundit class chooses to be deliberately confused. And just to go back to your initial point, Sam, I mean, I deliberately wrote this piece trying not to single out Fox, because I think Fox is an extreme version of the "what do they want? Well, I don't understand what they're saying" sort of response to Occupy Wall Street. But I think it's on a continuum of an enormous amount of cable TV news that just continues to behave as though this is incomprehensible. And so, you know, I would say that Fox is an extreme case, but I don't think that, at least until very recently, the media has done a very good job of understanding this. And so really my only point in writing the piece was that I was down at Occupy Wall Street on Saturday. If you can read a sign, you know what they want. And so I just am completely mystified and infuriated by this trope that we keep hearing that I don't understand. What do you think they want? Huh, they're so inscrutable to me. So the piece was really just an attempt to say that when an entire nation of protesters puts their demands on a cardboard sign because they are so completely fed up of media, you know that the media is failing, that they're going back to a much older tradition of protest in order to say, we don't really care what cable news thinks of us. We're not going to explain ourselves. We're going to hold up a sign and let them figure it out. And if they choose to be baffled, so be it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's so much to unpack here, because I'm really struck by how, Occupy Wall Street as a movement stands outside of the sort of like, you know, squabbles that take place within sort of the partisan bickering both in the sort of Fox arena and the let's call it the establishment arena.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about the establishment thing. So, you know, we talk about, we see people like Erin Burnett, or really, you know, I think she is the maybe the best illustration of that, and maybe one of the more extreme ones. But is it possible that part of like sort of the pundit class doesn't quite get what's going on because it's indicative of a larger disconnect that the press has with the concerns of people who aren't wealthy?
Well, I think it's more, I mean, I think that's a piece of it, Sam, but I think the more profound thing that has happened with the media is that there's just an expectation that for any, quote, movement to arise, it needs, you know, first and foremost, a message and a press strategy and a glossy PR. That there's just an expectation that you'll get faxed across your desk, or I guess faxing doesn't work anymore, but, you know, you're just going to get a PR statement across your desk, and that every group and every interest group, and everyone in America who has anything to say is going to sort of handcraft a message that the media can digest. And I think there's a, just a certain laziness that arises when you have a movement that has pretty much no interest in a glossy press strategy, that isn't going to distill it down to a bumper sticker, that isn't going to follow the, quote, rules of how to be a story. One of the things I pointed out in my Slate piece is that this isn't a great story for the way we have produced media, because we like solution stories. We like answers. And stories about inchoate frustration doesn't feel like a coverable story, so we ignore it. So I think there's a couple of things going on. I mean, I think there is a sort of class thing that you're flicking at, but I think there's a more fundamental problem, which is this is a movement that never had a press strategy because it wasn't really interested in Fox News and selling its story to Fox News in the first place.
Right, or it didn't, yeah, I guess it didn't have a, I guess a press strategy in the sense, I mean, they clearly now have a significant media strategy. It's just not commercial media.
Well, that's right.
And, you know, one of our longtime listeners on this program, who has been basically functioning now as a correspondent for us from down there, is working with the media team. And he had told us a couple of weeks ago exactly what you said. You know, the reporters come down here and they look at us and they're like, you know, where's the handout? Where's the packet? And we're just like, we're not giving you one. Go find out for yourself if you want to know what's going on. And this guy also, you know, he said at one point, he said, you know, we did make demands. We demanded that we occupy Zuccotti Park, and we've done it. And, you know, that's the one thing that I think sort of like the media cannot, and I think a lot of people can't quite absorb, is that there is a form and function type of thing here. The idea of occupying common space, it is essentially sending the message that we are reasserting our rights over the commons, which is really part of their broader message, yeah?
I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, the message was never a message qua message. I mean, bundled into the message, there are all these questions about corporate ownership of government and of income inequality and, you know, the divide between haves and have-nots. All that is bundled into it. And like I say, you just need to read the signs, and that's manifestly clear. But I think you're quite right. In the end, at bottom, this was an attempt to create a movement, to occupy something, to find common ground. And I think I would even add one more gloss over what we're saying about the media, and that is, yes, it's true, there's no handout when the CNN reporter comes down there. There's no pre-chewed pablum, you know, here's what we stand for. But there is an amazingly effective outreach. It's simply happening on Facebook. It's happening on Twitter. It's happening by way of good old-fashioned photographs that go viral on social media. So it just seems to me that what's really interesting isn't that this is a movement that's happening in a bubble. This is a national movement, but it's not spreading by way of traditional media. It's spreading in a way that makes perfect sense if you're one of those people who's checking on Facebook, who's checking on Twitter and following this in another forum. So I think there's a really interesting division here between a group that may not seem media savvy to the traditional mainstream corporate-owned media, but it's incredibly media savvy if you look at the way it's gotten its message out in a very compressed amount of time.
Right. I mean, I spent the night, like I was saying before we rang you up, I spent the night watching four or five different video streams of Occupy San Francisco, Oakland, two in New York. It's incredible. And, you know, of course, it's barely on TV. So let's move to the sort of the Fox end of the spectrum, because I also want to ask you a couple of legal questions. But first, I am really stunned at how hard Fox has tried to sort of get a wedge in here, and I include in this, you know, guys like Breitbart, and how much they've failed. I have literally seen over the past month, I mean, over the past couple of days even, I have seen Occupy Wall Street is driven by the Red Army. It is driven by the Muslim Brotherhood. It is driven by Acorn, which
Acorn,
no longer exists. It is anti-Semitic. It is anti-woman. It is they're throwing their feces around. I'm sure there's more. It's too Jewy. It's too anal. I mean, who knows what other things that they, but it's, why do you think it's not sticking? I mean, this is sort of the most curious aspect to me is, they're so desperate to get a wedge and they can't seem to get one even amongst their own people.
Well, I think that the just pragmatic answer, which is these themes that are the protesters have really given voice to, are universal themes in this country. I mean, Republicans, as much as Democrats, support the core values of this movement, which is, you know, the rich need to pay taxes. We can't cut spending on essential programs for poor and middle class families because rich people want to keep 0.5% of their tax dollars. And you don't have to be left or right. You don't have to be an MSNBC or Fox viewer to just see the fundamental sense in that. So I think one problem is, and it is a huge problem, is that as this theme of inequality in America really does begin to burgeon up and become, I think, the story of the We Are the 99% movement, that's going to be a thing that resonates with Fox viewers as much as it does anyone anywhere else. I mean, I think the other question you're asking, and I'm not a media strategist, but, you know, why can't Fox gain traction with these attempts to sort of create villains where none exist? I think it's because people are really smarter. Smarter than Bill Kristol thinks they are. So Bill Kristol can call this a rampantly anti-Semitic movement because one nut job is holding up a sign. But again, I think this goes to the power of the signs, because if you look at the guy holding up signs, in every photograph I've seen, and my husband took an amazing one, there's people standing around him saying, this guy's an idiot. He doesn't represent us.
Right.
So I think it's a movement that is disavowing,
not to mention,
sort of organically disavowing.
Right.
What's
not,
being,
what not
it's
to
being
mention
labeled
the
with.
500 people at Kol Nidre Services. That sort of undercuts the the anti-Semitic thing. It's just fascinating to me because they're really. I think when you got to dip into the acorn thing, you know you've got problems. I mean, you've got to basically attribute this movement to an organization that doesn't exist anymore. You really have problems, and I'm enjoying that. But I want to turn just to your legal expertise for a couple of things. One, you wrote a piece the other day about what to do if you're about to get arrested, it's becoming, you know, last night I was watching this feed from San Francisco. It was 3 in the morning, maybe 3:30 Eastern time, and they were interviewing, you know, guys who were running for mayor who were there, city supervisors. There, the people who were there in San Francisco, I would describe as sort of like the, you know, people we may, some of them anyways, as we may have described yuppies, 10 years ago or something. And so they were all prepared to get arrested. Which I found pretty interesting because you don't find, you know, a lot of professionals willing to go down there, you know, and get arrested per se. And what should people do in these circumstances? And then I want to talk to you about Oakland a little bit as well.
Well, I think, I mean, my short answer in my piece was, you know, we're lucky in some sense in this country, because if you want to get arrested, it's awfully easy to get arrested. But you can also not get arrested. In other words, I think one of the things that's going to be incumbent on the Occupies as they go forward is to make accommodations to the extent that they can so that the permits are legitimate, so that they're trying to their best of their abilities, you know, to do what happened in Wall Street, you know, to accommodate neighbors and to understand there are residents. I think the most important thing, and I said this in my piece, is find out, you know, the ACLU has tons of information. There are legal observers at every Occupy. Find out what their instructions are in terms of each locale. Find out what, you know, they're saying you can do and what you can't. It is the case in this country that we think we have unlimited First Amendment right to protest. But in fact, as long as the government is putting forward what are called neutral time, place, and manner regulations, we have to follow them. And one of the things that I wrote a lot about that's really interesting is this question of whether sleeping as part of a protest is protective First Amendment activity. The Supreme Court, by the way, has said it isn't. So that's just a problem going forward. I think these are venue-by-venue questions, Sam. I think, you know, Zuccotti Park is really different because it's a privately owned public space. It's not a public park. And so it's doubly confounded. A lot of these issues are going to get worked out in the courts. You know, what are the rights of protesters? Are these time, place, and manner regulations fair and neutral, or are they pretextual? But I think the best advice I have, I think I said it in the column, is first of all, write your lawyer's name down on your hand because they're going to take your stuff. And that to the extent that you cannot escalate, be civil, be respectful. I think those are useful things. Now, we haven't seen in a long time in this country city government trying to balance its needs for, you know, safety and security against massive, massive, large-scale demonstrations that go on for weeks. So these are going to be issues that really get resolved city by city, conflict by conflict. And hopefully, I think on both sides, cities and the police are going to be respectful of the rights of protesters. But more deeply, I think protesters need to really think through what is the goal here. Is the goal here to make a statement? Is the goal here to go out and get arrested? And I think this is a movement that's thinking through that issue in really complicated ways. But I think it's early time, Sam. We're going to have to see how it plays out.
Right. Now, the couple of things about one thing I wanted to ask you about Oakland. We had a woman call into the program yesterday who was one of the first arrested the other night. And there were two things that she said. Well, there was many things she said, actually. I mean, she has MS. She brought her medication down there. One of the cops was going to try and deny her the medication. One thing she said, upon release, they basically told her, do not go back to the park. If we see you in the park, we will hold you until December 5th. We will triple your bail, and we'll hold you to December 5th until your trial. Can the police do that? I mean, how do they issue that type of edict? Can they put you on that like type of parole for a what I guess amounted to a trespassing violation?
I'm going to be really careful not to give anything that sounds like legal advice, and forgive me if I sound like a lawyer, because I don't want to.
I was raised by a family of lawyers.
Exactly.
So you
know, they caveat their, you know, your dessert selection. I'm not committing to anything, but I think that one of the things you're going to see, and Naomi Wolf had a great post about this last week about a conflict she got into with New York police, who were taking the position that somehow the sidewalk was owned by Huffington Post for, you know, I mean, you're going to hear a lot of crazy things, I think. And Naomi Wolf did a really good job, I commend her column, of making really, really clear that the sidewalks aren't owned by magazines for the night. But I think that, you know, I'm going to go back to what I said, which is it seems to me that in each and every situation we're going to see play out around the country, be it in Oakland or Cleveland or Chicago or on the Brooklyn Bridge, there's going to be different issues that arise. Different police are going to say different things. I think some of the police in these cases have been incredibly sympathetic to the protesters. Some have not been.
Right.
But it just seems to me that, you know, again, my strong, strong advice is, you know, you don't have to say anything. You do have to let them search you. Have your lawyer's name written on your hand. Find out in advance from legal observers in your local ACLU and other groups what your rights are, and really go into these situations knowing what your rights are, what you do have to do when you're arrested, what you do not have to do, and just be polite. Don't escalate. I think that's the best advice I can give as a very, very general matter.
And I will also say, because whenever I'm talking to a lawyer, I always end up, you know, becoming even more contrarian than I am normally. That there's two different sort of tacks to take in these situations. There's sort of the movement law tact, and then just simply the straight on law tact, right? I mean, that a movement lawyer would say, oh yeah, no, you want to get into these situations because you can actually make a bit of a show of it. And from a movement perspective, the last thing you want to do is sort of cut a deal. You want to try and take this as much to, you want to create as much of a sort of, not a conflict with the police, but in terms of the law. Right? Does that make sense?
I think it makes sense. I mean, that sort of transcends the legal question and goes
right.
to, I think, this very, very tough tactical question, which all of the occupiers are now facing, which is, what do we want to stand for? Do we want to be, you know, the folks who were arrested when they were clearing out the park, or do we want to be, you know, protesters who are able to, as you said in the very beginning, Sam, you know, collect in public spaces and get our message across? And it seems to me that I don't have a very, very strong sense yet of which way the occupiers want to go, and it may be different for different locations. But I do think that that's a very, very fundamental sort of tactical question that needs to be asked. And I also think that it was really interesting to see even the fight about the drum circle in New York as it slowly worked its way out. That was a concession that we want to be here, but we want to be heard, and we don't want to be those guys who drove everyone crazy. So I think that these are, again, this is such an organic movement. It is a leaderless movement. And these issues are getting resolved in really, I think, organic but inchoate ways to the rest of us. And so we're just going to have to, I think, see what the groups determine their values are on that tactical question.
Dahlia Lithwick from Slate.com, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
It's always a thrill. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, got some more sound from last night. Update on what's happening in Thailand. Oh, the Super Committee, News Corp, and more. We'll be right back in just a moment. All right, folks, Sam Teeter back on the Majority Report. Just a little bit of house cleaning here. I want to say thank you to Jay, otherwise known as Scouroboros, who has been very generous over the years, a big supporter of female roller derby. I don't know. Is there male roller derby? I'm not sure about it. But he sent us two significant size monitors that apparently he reconditioned. They both they're fantastic. And muffins. I feel very reluctant to talk about the muffins because I don't want to get food. Now Matt, on the other hand, who I made take all the muffins. I had three, but I had three in about 4 minutes it took me to have three of them. And I said, you got to take these home because I can't do this. So Matt wants more muffins, but I say no muffins. I just can't eat that stuff.
Fair enough.
I went to Countdown last night. I had four cookies in the green room before going on. It's ridiculous. Also, I want to remind you, podcastawards.com. Today is the final day?
Today is the final day.
Today is the final day of voting, 8 p.m. Eastern. So head to podcastawards.com. Don't forget they're going to send you an email.
You have until 8 p.m.
You have until 8 p.m. Eastern. Confirmation, they'll send you a confirmation email. You got to click through that. We are up for People's Choice and Best News and Politics if you can. I want to read this email. Yesterday we made the whole show available because of that interview that we did with Alyssa calling in from Occupy Oakland. I just thought it was just too important of an email of an interview. We also included the report from Tim Johnson because we're hearing nothing about what's going on in Thailand. As far as I can tell, I'm watching the news fairly regularly. I see nothing about it. And got an email from Todd J. My wife is Thai. Anyway, Tim Johnson's 100% right. It is FUBAR there now, speaking of Thailand. My wife is Thai. She's been in near constant contact with her mother and sister. The situation is extremely dire for not just Bangkok, but the surrounding provinces also. There is much more that Tim could have gotten into as well as myself, but it's just too much to type right now. I'm at work and on break. Back several years ago, there was a prime minister who was run out of office by a military coup because of his corruption of the government. He was found guilty and half of his assets were seized and he fled the country. He still has over $2 billion in wealth and is living in Dubai. recent elections elected his former party, led by his sister, and they won, and she is now prime minister. But she has no political experience, and I don't think that she's that great of a businesswoman. Tim was right about them lying to the Thai people that things were going to be fine. So millions of people could have fled earlier or prepared better, but ran out of time. My wife's sister just barely got out in the last 18 hours from this writing. Also, what is unbelievable is that this is making almost no mainstream news. The entire Thai economy could be devastated for some time. Their rice crops, which is its number one export, make almost 75% of the world's, they make 75% of the world's disk drives and other tech products. They have several automobile plants that have been entirely flooded out, including Toyota and Honda. Even the parts used in U.S. cars are manufactured there and will affect the plants in America. But Tim was so correct about the people. They are going to be the hardest hit. People's houses, cars, livelihoods are going to be destroyed. It's an economic nightmare almost as devastating as the earthquake and tsunami in Japan. In fact, over one-third of the country is flooded right now, and the U.S. government has done almost nothing to help either. Thanks so much for having Tim on yesterday. It's a start, and I know that you really do care. We have limited resources for this program, and I don't know there'll ever be a time where we could actually, make the proactive choice to report on stuff like this beyond the fact that, we have listeners who are around the country. I think we had some really interesting reports from Wes in Japan following the tsunami. And Tim is giving us some reports from Thailand. And I encourage, people to call into this program, do it in the post show, in the better half of the show, and, to keep us updated. Sometimes we'll open up the calls before then, but I've been stunned at how little coverage what's been going on in Thailand has been getting in this country, because it does seem like the country is being devastated. With that said, moving on, Tony Baloney transferred to Staten Island. He is now what we call a house mouse. He'll be sitting at a desk job. In Staten Island. So
some are saying it's kind of a reward for him, actually, because apparently he lives just like a mile or two away.
Yeah, it was a deal. It makes it sound like he's getting demoted to everybody else, and he is, but the dude's close to retirement anyways, probably.
I mean, they're just moving him around, which is what the Catholic Church did to pedophile priests.
That's what I was really looking for. Matt, going to town. Let's listen to this audio from last night. Let's listen to this audio. I will leave you with this audio, and then we're going to go into the after show, the better half of the show. We'll talk about what's happening with the Super Committee, and we will listen to just the unbelievable Herman Cain production that is just – the smoking one was insane. But this one is just insanely bad. Like, the smoking one, I actually thought, oh, this is – I could watch this forever because it's just so bizarre. It's like that B.J. Snowden. You know that's B.J. Snowden music I would play? In Canada. It's like where it's so bad it's good. Well, Herman Cain has followed up with something that is so bad,
it's awful.
It's worse than so bad that it's good. It's just bad. Before we get there, here is a member of the 99% in this country walking in the middle of a super committee hearing. Where the guy who's speaking, I think, was Doug Elmendorf. He is the head of the CBO. And it really is, you know, we'll talk about what the Democrats proposed. It was horrible. I mean, fortunately, the Republicans are so bat crap crazy that they would never accept it. But politically speaking, it was probably a mistake by Democrats. But nevertheless, I'm sure they would have loved those douchebags, would love to have cut Medicare. They don't care at all. They do. I mean, for them, it's not an issue. So, but the simplicity of having this one woman walk into the middle of this hearing. And, you know, it's everybody's in their place. It's so rigid. You've got people sitting in the galley. You've got people sitting at the witness table, as it were, the testifier table. And then the round dais where people are sitting up there looking down on the guy giving testimony. And everybody's in their place. It's all for this theater. Based on this notion that we should be cutting government at this time, which has no basis in economic reality whatsoever. And this woman comes in and just basically gives the answer in about 20 seconds, which is raise taxes on the rich, end the wars. That's about 50% of what you need to do. And it's pretty easy to get. Matt, let's play this audio. It is number two, and then we will head out for the better half of the show.
Programs is up to you, as you know.
Thank you. I yield back, Madam Chair.
The American people want to
the committee will
be
in order, please.
Fix the deficit. And all this obfuscation with percentages of GDP, this is just trying to confuse the issue.
The chair wishes to remind all of our guests that
the public wants you to tax the rich in the war. We spend more on
I would request that the Capitol please restore order.
And this history of this vast, grotesque spending on wars and the war machine.
The committee shall recess until we are in order.
The base of this economy. We would have enough money for housing and health care and everything that we want if we stopped spending our money in this black hole of the military machine. It's very obvious. I speak to the 99% in the war to tax the rich.
There you go. End the wars, tax the rich, provide us with health care. Do what government's supposed to do. Put my audio on, I might hear it a little bit. Have it on. Folks, I will see you in the better half of the program. You can call me at 646-257-3922, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. I promise we will play the Herman Cain ad. Oh, also, I guess it hasn't been that long. We will talk about the Scott Olson thing.
Hey, this came out. This came out after we ended the show yesterday.
A Marine was hit on the head with a canister of tear gas and is in pretty bad shape.
Critical condition with skull fracture.
And almost what's worse is what they did when people came to help this guy. We'll talk about it in the better half of the program. We'll be right back. You can always support the show by going to podcastawards.com. Voting, last chance today. Also, if you can become a member, we need your support. That's at the end of the day. I wouldn't give a crap about awards, frankly, if it wasn't for the opportunity to perhaps get more members down the road. So we cut out the middleman. Just become a member. And who gives a crap about an awards vote? You can also support justcoffee.coop. And buy your crap through our Amazon link at majority.fm. We're going to have a redesign of the blog soon. It's going to be pretty exciting. And I'm not just whistling Dixie on that one. All right, folks. See you in the better half of the program.